Thank you, Nicholas, for that amazing introduction. It's always very strange to hear oneself described. I'm just getting organised here. I've got a number of things. First of all, I think I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, who are the original inhabitants of the land on which we are meeting tonight. And the title I've chosen is Working My Way Through the Colour Chart. And Nick has alluded to that in his introduction. Now, he's also said that I've recently moved, which means that I don't have a business card. So what I've done instead of having a business card is, I don't think I've done enough of these, but I've made little cards for a number of people. They're actually from the colour chart in the paint shop, you know, and I've put my website address on the back. So it's Home Hardware, but that's got nothing to do with anything. People will get different coloured cards, you see. So if you just take a card until they run out, and so you work your way through the colour chart there. Yes, I was doing it on the aircraft as I was coming here, and I think the man next to me was wondering what I was doing. Yeah. I wasn't wondering what he was doing. He was a businessman working on his computer, so he was, you know, legitimate human being. Which is the sort of thing that Barbara Hanrahan might have said, mightn't she? Now, when you look at the work a writer has produced over a decent period of time, you often see patterns that can appear to follow a conscious plan. Sometimes such a plan does in fact exist. In my own case, there was no plan in this sense, but the patterns are certainly there. One of the most obvious motifs is that of colour, for you can see from my titles, The Bluebird Cafe, The White Garden, Red Shoes, and another book which I edited called Red Hot Notes, and the novel that will be published next year called The Green Language. You can see that I have a bit of a preoccupation with colour and the significance of colour. For argument's sake, I am classifying white as a colour, and I'd forgotten, of course, that The Stolen Children, their stories would classify as a black book. I remember when I was a child, one of my favourite words was just the word colour. I loved to say it and I loved to hear people say it. And a phrase I adored was coloured pencils. Yeah, nice, isn't it? Actually, I realise I also loved the words pastels and chalks and paints. My tin of Derwents was one of my pet possessions, drawing and colouring a favourite pastime. Few of my artworks have survived, but in the books that I have saved from childhood, there is evidence of colouring. In Peter Pan, the line drawings are all coloured in, and even my old piano music has its illustrated sections carefully filled in with the beloved Derwents. Sweet, yeah. I suppose none of this is unusual, but the adult labelling of my novels and so on with colour tags seems to invite examination. Among my short stories, one of my favourites, and I have many, is called Kay Pettman's Coloured Pencils. It was written in 1987. The title sprang into my mind as a fully formed phrase, recollected from childhood. There was a girl called Kay Pettman. I loved her name, and I also loved the way she said, coloured pencils. So I just started to write a story. I realised that it can be a bit maddening when a writer says that, so I just started to write a story. But that is more or less, actually, how these things happen. The story follows the teenage life of an Australian girl in the 1950s. It focuses on her dilemma. Will she become an artist, a dress designer, or will she marry and live a life similar to that of her stay-at-home mother, a life that is represented as being wholesome but kind of uneventful? The catalyst in this decision-making is the Italian woman who teaches art at Kay's school. This is how the character of the art teacher is introduced. I'll quote, "Francesca Battista was exotic. She was little, 30, dark, beautiful, unmarried, mysterious, artistic and Roman Catholic. She also drove a car. She comes whispering into Kay's life, holding up before Kay the glamorous possibilities of life outside the circle of being a Deb, marrying the right local boy, having a proper house and family, and never having a real job or vocation outside the home. I notice in my recent reading of the story that the pavement in the Petman Garden is described as crazy paving. Now there's a clue. Miss Battista has decided to try to save Kay from her suburban life and fate. It will be done through art, through colour. There is a sense of the presence of watching deities or angels, and there is also the matter of an icon of the Black Virgin Mary that Kay glimpses at Francesca's house. Kay is being lured out of the comfort zone of the life that has been planned for her. Through education, art, mystery and colour, she's being drawn away into the danger zone of other and even foreign possibilities. What will she do? The story never states how she decides, but the opinion of the narrator as to what Kay ought to do for the sake of her soul is never in doubt. She must break away from the crazy paving and fly out into the world of true colour. Incidentally, if nothing else places Kay's mother as the demon of the piece, the fact that she hoses the leaves from the crazy paving will these days be enough to put her beyond the pale. She is personally responsible for the global shortage of clean water. Now, I could go on and on as a reader analysing this story, but I confess that as the writer of the story, I worked pretty much unconsciously. So a reader sees all the clues, such as the crazy paving and the mother goddess and so forth, and is quite right to read them for what they are, for the service they are doing to the meaning of the narrative. But I can assure you that as the writer, I gave no real thought to the purpose and significance of them. They, as I said before, arrived in the story in response to the story itself. This is really very tricky to explain. Such matters are, in a sense, beyond my control, as is the manner in which colour keeps surfacing in my work. I can explore it, I can analyse it, but I can't really explain it. So this evening I will engage in an exploration and perhaps some analysis of the role of the colour chart or the colour wheel or the palette in my writing. The first novel published in 1990, I've sort of slid over Cherry Ripe, which of course is a colour too. I'm skipping to the Bluebird Cafe in 1990, the Bluebird Cafe, and I can't for the life of me recall why I wanted to call it that. Isn't that awful? I can't remember. Why did I want to have a novel called The Bluebird Cafe? I do remember that this was its title from the very beginning. But it just seems to have been visited upon me, visited upon the novel. I don't know. I do remember how much I loved it, the title, and how inspiring I found it to work from. I do remember also that for a long time in the writing, the first line of the novel was, quote, "You can imagine the Bluebird Cafe." But late in the writing, I realised that this was not the first line, but it was, in fact, the last line, and so I shifted it. I can tell you that the work of Maurice Maeterlinck, who wrote The Bluebird, made into a movie with Shirley Temple, has always fascinated me. And, of course, to take his title and reduce it to a rural Tasmanian roadhouse is probably both irreverent and admiring in one gesture. At this point in the construction of this talk I'm giving you, I thought, why did I pick this way of discussing my work? This question of colour, it's just the hardest thing to talk about. I have set myself one of these problems I talked about before, a writer sets herself a problem and the writing is the response to the problem that she has set herself. What made me fix on a cafe, a little old bluebird cafe, as the central place and central image of the novel? I don't know. Does the blueness signify? If so, what does it signify and why? Now, it's one thing to talk about what blue might mean to readers in general, different things to different people, but I think it has a broad appeal as the colour of hope, also as the colour of wisdom. But I know it also signifies despair and depression, which are the other side of hope, which is, I suppose, why the bluebird is a carrier of happiness and hope. Green also is a signifier of hope, but I'll come to green later. The Bluebird Cafe, in the Bluebird Cafe, I wanted to place a powerful and lyrical image of hope and joy at the forefront of the reader's mind. And after all the awful things that happen in the narrative, as Nicholas has referred to, awful things that happen in my narratives, there was a couple of women came up to me at the Sydney Writers' Festival last year and said that they were readers of my work, and then one of them said, "Why do you always write about such awful things?" But of course the response to that is that that is what stories do. They investigate where things go wrong. Anyway, after all the awful things that happen in the narrative, hope is in fact all that is left. And the last sentence, as I said, you can imagine the Bluebird Cafe, passes the responsibility on to the reader and passes on also the hope. I speak of the awful things that happen in the narrative, and I possibly need to clarify that my literary novels, the ones I'm discussing here as it happens, in them, colours don't seem to have had the same role in my other novels. My literary novels are concerned with dark events that disrupt the pleasant lives of the characters. Fiction, and much storytelling in general, is concerned to some degree with such disruption. Take the story of Cinderella, a reasonably typical storyline. The good child's life is made miserable by the stepmother. The child perseveres in hope, and with the intervention of magic, she triumphs and finds love, a love fortunately characterised by luxury and comfort in the form of a prince and a palace, etc. If the trajectory of the story was that once upon a time there was a good little girl who grew up to marry a prince and live happily ever after, there would in fact be no story. This is what bugs people, I suppose, with the story of Princess Mary. It is not story. It's not story enough for the readers that she was a commoner who married a prince. That's a good start for a story. But the readers, faithfully fed by the magazines, long for Mary to suffer. To suffer some kind of dark deeds before she can emerge again and live happily ever after. This is what stories do. The story of Princess Diana is particularly attractive for its utterly dark and tragic ending. I'm sorry to have drifted into the narrative of the princesses, but they are very useful when discussing the ways stories work, what stories are about and how they develop. You need the deep darks in order for the highlights to function as part of a story. Otherwise, the highlights are just a string of bright beads. Even the simplest kind of baby story will tell a child that to begin with, a little dog had no friends, but he ended up, through various manoeuvres, with at least one friend. Human beings yearn for some kind of happy element in the end. Romeo and Juliet may end with the deaths of the lovers, but it seems that with the death may come peace among the warring families. Or had you forgotten that? That's how it ends. In the novels I'm discussing, terrible things do happen, crimes and disasters. But there is a level at which the narrative is searching for equilibrium and searching for beauty. And to me it seems colour is a marker of this, a signifier of the good and the beautiful, even though the white and the red and indeed the black and the green are also made use of in the text for dark and evil purposes. The red shoes in the novel Red Shoes are the shoes of little children who have been stolen in various ways by a religious cult for the purpose of establishing a new world order. The colour red itself carries a powerful range of suggestions from rage to love and many qualities in between. Similarly, white, there's innocence and there's death, for starters. I didn't set out to take my readers through the colours, moving in the titles from blue to white to red to green, but that is how it has worked. Red, between red and green, there comes chronologically a novel called Cape Grim. Now, if there were a colour embedded in that title, I would see it as black. Again, taking black as a colour, for argument's sake. And a funny thing about this is that by the time I was writing Cape Grim, I saw the three novels, The White Garden, Red Shoes and Cape Grim, as a trilogy, working in no particular order under the alchemical colours of black, white and red. But I could not shift my use of the title Cape Grim to take in the word black. It would not shift. Now, I know that sounds funny, but the title was there, it belonged to the novel, and the title wouldn't move. To say a title has some sort of will of its own is strange, but that is the case for me anyhow. I spoke earlier of setting out to take my readers somewhere. This is itself a rather misleading idea. I do, in fact, set out to examine and perhaps to solve a group of problems that I set myself, or problems I perceive as being worth my attention. Of course, there is the hope and expectation that I will, in the process, render the problem and the resolution engaging enough for readers to enjoy exploring it with me. I suppose I am, to an extent, talking about inspiration here. What inspired me to write Cape Grim, for instance? Well, it was a series of events in the history of far northwest Tasmania from way back up to about the year 2000, taking in shipwrecks, settlement, massacres, the usual things. The Port Arthur massacre was a kind of touch paper that set the novel going, although the narrative does not examine Port Arthur in any literal way at all. When I was creating the character of the man who was responsible for the massacre in my novel, I had a mental image of photographs of Martin Bryant from Port Arthur, but I also had thoughts of Jim Jones and Marshall Applewhite to guide my imagination. The name and the place, Cape Grim, has in fact inspired me since childhood. To return to where I spoke of the search for equilibrium and also beauty, I should explain that I see fiction at some level as a search for order and meaning. Now, that sounds rather lofty, but if you think about it, it isn't just literary novels at the high end that seek meaning and order. The simplest and most banal love story or adventure story with no pretensions to high art or literary glamour or whatever it is, the most basic novel is usually bringing a view of order into the chaos of existence in some way or other. Crime novels, fantasy novels, they are all working in the service of finding an order and a meaning, even if the meaning turns out to be meaninglessness. You can see that once I set out to examine my own work, I can get myself into the middle of a maze. At that point, I can begin to panic. Keep calm and think of bluebirds. Now, that's not really a careless comment, for there is often, sometimes, a fairy tale reference in my work, and there is a wonderful old French fairy tale called The Bluebird. It works somewhat along the lines of Cinderella, with the prince spending much of his time as a bluebird, until eventually, after many ups and downs, he is restored to human form, and the evil stepsister is turned into an owl. There is a depth of human wisdom and poetic truth in such fairy tales that appeals to me so profoundly that I find I make conscious and unconscious reference to such stories and their details quite often in my work. I am not particularly interested in constructing modern versions of the old tales, but I sometimes find pleasure and satisfaction in recalling elements of them as I write, even if nothing obvious or overt from the old story makes its way into the story I am telling. I suppose that as well as seeking order and beauty, equilibrium and meaning, I am also seeking some kind of wise calm, something that informs the folk and fairy tales that attract me. I have a slight cold and I visited a pharmacist in Rundle Mall, and he gave me something or other that he said would stop my nose from dripping. There is also the puzzle and bewilderment at the heart of the magical. Sometimes there are no answers to the mysterious, and that appeals to me too. Perhaps it is in counterpoint to this fantastical thread that I have a great interest in the factual backgrounds to my narratives. Such is this fascination that in some of my novels, in particularly The Bluebird Cafe, Red Shoes and Cape Grim, I have provided the text with a substantial glossary which is integral to the novel, yet gives the reader the option of reading it or ignoring it. You can just read the story and forget the glossary, or you can work with the glossary. The glossaries work like an old-fashioned form of the hyperlink. Now, my new novel, The Green Language, which won't be published until next year, has escaped this treatment. Again, this was not a conscious decision. It just didn't develop that way. I think that green has been my lifelong abiding favourite colour, the colour of youth and the natural world. It is the colour that rushes through the heart and blood of poetry. The Spanish poet Lorca wrote a whole poem in praise of green. Green, green, I love you, green. I also adore the complementary colour on the colour wheel, being, of course, red. It doesn't surprise me that I have written a novel called The Green Language. But as I have said, I can't truly explain why this is so. I have a feeling that to explain or to try to explain these things is in some way to traduce them, to falsify them. Perhaps I'm working my way through the colour chart, but then I have to work my way through something. That is what a writer is, in one sense, doing, working their way through something in search of something, the second something being, as I have suggested, some form of meaning. The medium everybody works through on the meaning project is their own life. Everyone will have a different way of expressing this to themselves. Writing fiction is one way of doing it, only one. Writing memoir is another. It's probably a more obvious one, but not unrelated to writing fiction. Perhaps the main puzzle everyone has is something like, who am I and what am I doing here? The answer can be as short or as long as you like. Now, why don't I read you the Kay Pettman story that I started by talking about? Here is a girl at the crossroads. Kay Pettman's Coloured Pencils. This was a time when families had only one car. After breakfast, the fathers would drive to work in the cars, the children would catch the bus to school, and the mothers would do the breakfast dishes. There was a sort of whine the cars make as they arrived home in the early evening and were locked up in the garages for the night. Each woman was sensitive to the whine of her husband's car, and when she heard it, she would take off her apron, hang the tea towel on the hook, and put on an oven mitt. For now it was time to take the dinner from the oven. There were sounds of the gate being closed behind the car, the gentle chatter of the engine as the car was being eased into the garage, then the click and grind as the garage doors were closed. God's watching from above could see through the roof of the houses as if they were glass, and could see the mothers putting the meat and vegetables on the tables, see the children in their bedrooms closing their history textbooks before washing their hands for the evening meal. Goodness me! Okay, so that little section was called Watching from Above. The next section, it's all divided into little sections, is called When a Girl Marries. The gods saw two rows of houses on either side of a gravel street. This was after the Second World War, before television, before the pill. Some houses had cellars where boxes of faded photographs and broken kitchen chairs gathered mould. Some had little attics where trunks of crumpled ball gowns collected dust. Between the attics and the cellars were rooms full of everyday life, busy with pop-up toasters, vacuum cleaners, pressure cookers, and radios that told the story. Each house was surrounded by a garden. In the front, there were lawns with flowers and borders. At the back, there was a lemon tree and a circular clothesline. Next to most back fences was a little hen house, and beside some of the hen houses were the trapdoors leading to the trenches which the fathers had dug for the safety of the families in the event of an invasion of Japanese. Number 10. Jack and Margaret Petman lived at number 10. They had a daughter called Kay who was rather pretty. She looked quite good in her high school dress. The dress was pale blue with a white collar and was worn with a Panama hat and white gloves. Kay always got very good marks in English and history and art. She was going to art school when she was 17, but first she was going to be a Deb. It was one of the things her mother had been looking forward to for years. Apples kept well in the trench. Kay would sit at the desk in her bedroom, drawing the designs for her Deb dress with inks and coloured pencils. The background of the drawing was a dream forest of carefully drawn leaves and bright flowers, against which the white spun sugar of the dress blazed and sparkled. Kay put some of the designs in her satchel. She was going to take them to school, where she would show them to Miss Batista, the art teacher. Next section's called Danger. Francesca Batista was exotic. She was little, 30, dark, beautiful, foreign, unmarried, mysterious, artistic, and Roman Catholic. She also drove a car. When Margaret Petman was doing the sheets and towels in her washing machine, and when Jack Petman was checking the level of the brine for the icy poles at the ice cream factory, Francesca was squeezing bright oil paints onto palettes for the girls in the art room. Kay watched as the soft snake of yellow ochre slid onto the wood. "Miss Batista, can I show you the designs for my dress?" When Francesca saw the drawings, she decided to save Kay before it was too late. The invitation. So, while Margaret hoses the leaves from the crazy paving, Francesca says to Kay, "Would you like to bring your designs to my house on Saturday?" Kay goes funny inside with surprise and pleasure at the invitation and says, "I'll ask my mother." They are making pineapple icy poles at the ice cream factory. The next bit's called Idea. After the ball and after she leaves school and before she gets married, Kay could get a job in an office at the ice cream factory. It's an idea. The next section is called Saturday. Kay is allowed to go to the art teacher's house with the drawings for the Deb dress. Margaret reminds her that the ball is in 6 months' time and everything will have to be settled before too long. There is also the question of a partner. Is she going to get round to asking Robert Scott quite soon? Because if she doesn't hurry up, somebody else will ask him. Somebody such as Mary Robinson, for instance. And has Kay heard that Mary got 91 in her grade 5 piano exam? Jack is mowing the lawn. They talk about dreams. That's a little heading. In Miss Batista's flat, all the little windows are open, and calico curtains with borders of blue flowers flap a bit in the wind. Insects fly in and settle as Miss Batista admires their colour and form. On a pale table, a yellow bowl of daisies blooms, a white cat, the smell of expensive perfume, huge velvet cushions. Miss Batista is cleaning her teeth. They have cakes and coffee and talk about French poetry and Botticelli and the Divine Comedy and the stars. The dresses Kay has drawn are very pretty. So are the forests. Where did she get the forests from? From dreams. They talk about dreams. Miss Batista sketches as she talks. She hums. Kay is drawing too. There is a sweet scratch-scratch of their pencils on the drawing blocks. "May I?" says Miss Batista and corrects the line of the daisy Kay is drawing. a query from the gods. Is that how it happened then? How Kay Pettman stepped out one Saturday, straight off the straight and narrow path of her mother's crazy paving, and down among the primroses, waving goodbye to Robert Scott as he waltzes in the moonlight with Mary Robinson in his arms. Such a simple little thing, so sweet and very Italian. And she lifts her finger and Kay Pettman says, "Oh, yes, yes, I never wanted to be a deb at the Masonic Ball. I'll get a job and save up and go to Italy." The shiny skin of the earth is the next little section. Jack is cleaning the car and waxing it. He does a thorough job. The three-year-old girl at number 14 has sliced the top off her finger with a wire for cutting cheese. Kay goes into Francesca's laundry to wash her hands. A little picture is stuck crookedly in a corner of the window frame. It shocks Kay. A black Madonna in jeweled robe, black child. Their crowns are held up by angels in short skirts. Kay stares at the picture with her mouth half open. In what is known as a split second, she sees some bright thing springing from the darkest cracks of the bleeding earth. The rocks are ripped apart, and an unearthly light screams swiftly in across the light of day. She washes her hands and returns to her drawing. "There is something the matter," says Francesca, Mozart piano concertos playing softly. "Nothing the matter," says Kay. And then in brackets it says, "I have seen something black and terrible. If I go back to the laundry and look at it again, will it still be there, staring so sadly, looking through the skin of my eyes into the stream of my blood, the look swirling round and round in me until my heart is pierced and split with slashes, cut with a burning sword? Or if I go back, will the picture be gone? Did it bubble out from the shiny skin of the earth, stick to the window for just a minute, and then dissolve into the thin air? Sail through the little invisible cracks in the ceiling of the laundry." It's the end of the bracket. "In Italy," says Francesca, "the sky is quite a different blue, you know." Margaret Pettman is peeling parsnips. "I better be going home now," says Kay. Jack is putting away the car. "Come again another time. What about next Saturday?" I have to go to the first rehearsal for the ball." Francesca's eyes are brown as the eyes of a deer. Mary Robinson is speaking to Robert Scott's mother. Robert will be home from football soon. Kay lines up all her pencils in the tin. And that's the end of the story. Okay.